And a related point, people are underestimating the pernicious aspect of inflation. This will catch up with them, just as it caught up with American consciousness in 1972 and 1973. Nobody paid attention to increases in gas price until they found that they'd increased from 20 cents to a dollar. Nobody paid much attention to the increase in the price of a hamburger at McDonald's until it went from 20 cents to 75 cents. But the cumulative and compounding impact of inflation over 5 years rather than one ambushed America. And I'm afraid it's going to ambush America now.
Rick Rule, good afternoon to you, my friend. Really good to see you. It's been a little bit while. How are you?
I'm doing very well. The better for being back with you, Andy. Thank you for having me back.
You're anytime, and you're way too kind to me. So I've been thinking a lot about everything that's really going on in the economy, and I think you have a unique perspective because of your involvement in natural resource companies and the natural resource sector, but also with in the banking sector and Battle Bank. I am getting a certain, well, I guess I should see it anecdotally. I see my grocery costs go exceptionally high. I see when I tank up my car go exceptionally high. But I don't really see a whole lot of panic in the general public. All we have is people whining about, which I'm whining about it, higher prices. Wanted to get your perspective as a banker, what's going on in the economy, and then I'll have a bunch of follow-up questions after that. But yeah, give me your two cents.
Well, both of your observations are true. The fact is that I think that we were schooled by 40 years of benign economic climate, the period 1982 to 2022, to expect the worst. Pardon me, expect the best, the exact opposite. Declining real interest rates, declining nominal interest rates, a very strong US dollar, an expanding economy. And I think that people's expectation of the future was set by their experience in the immediate past, which is causing them to ignore some of the not so rosy changes that have happened in the period 2023 to present, particularly inflation. And this reminds me so much of the last part of the 1960s, where we were coming off an economic boom in the 1950s and 1960s, and people shrugged off the inflation that they experienced at the end of the 1960s until the compounding effect of inflation came and whacked them in the face in 72 and 73. So I think that the benign response to inflation is really a function of the fact that people's expectations were schooled over 40 good years. And I think they'll change. The perception that you have about inflation, by the way, is really, really real. Many people conflate inflation with the CPI. Which I believe substantially understates inflation. In the first instance, when it's inconvenient, it doesn't include food or fuel. Any index that doesn't include lunch is of no value to me whatsoever. Probably more importantly, it doesn't include tax. If tax wasn't part of my cost of living, I guess I would react less violently. But my own experience, Andy, is that the basket of goods and services that I consume is increasing in price between 8 and 10% compounded a year, not 2.5. Other speakers have referred to the CPI as the CP lie, which I think is a fairly good explainer. One of the things, Andy, that becomes practical in terms of this discussion is, as you know, I think I began saving principally in gold in 2000, in the year 2000, at the turn of the century. And one of the things I do to amuse myself is that I try to calculate roughly my net worth, my income, and my expenses in gold every year, not just relying on the US dollar. If you do that, you're struck by how cheap housing is. You're struck by how cheap your groceries are. You're struck by how cheap energy is. You run those same expenses through the metric of the US dollar, And you find that it isn't so much that energy prices have gone up, the real price of energy in, denominated in gold has gone down. But the US dollar price is crazy. So there's a couple of lessons there. The first is that investors, not investors necessarily, but citizens are living a bit beyond their means. Their expectation for the future was set by the 40 most benign economic years in the history of mankind. I'm not trying to say that what comes before us is a really ugly, precipitous crisis, but I am trying to say that many people are unprepared for what is coming at them. And a related point, people are underestimating the pernicious aspect of inflation. This will catch up with them, just as it caught up with American consciousness in 1972 and 1973. Nobody paid attention to increases in gas price until they found that they'd increased from 20 cents to a dollar. Nobody paid much attention to the increase in the price of a hamburger at McDonald's until it went from 20 cents to 75 cents. But the cumulative and compounding, in fact, impact of inflation over 5 years rather than one ambushed America. And I'm afraid it's going to ambush America now. The second lesson is that you have to diversify your savings. This may sound like a commercial for Battle Bank, and it is, but we're coming into a period of increased volatility between currencies. And the idea that you denominate all of your savings in one currency, particularly in a global economy where the world is 22% of the global economy, if you save just in US dollars, you're ignoring 78% of the savings alternatives in the world. And then, of course, there's gold. If you believe, as I believe, and I believe that the US dollar loses 75% of its purchasing power over the next 10 years. It is, I think, imperative that you at least consider putting some of your savings in an asset which has a millennium-long track record of maintaining its real purchasing power, which is to say, gold. It isn't right for everybody. I get that. But it sure has been right for me. As I say, when I look at the basket of goods and services that I consume, and I look at them in dollar terms, I'm horrified. And when I look at them in gold terms, I'm amused. I would prefer that more of your listeners became amused than horrified.
Yeah, me too. Where do you get the 75% number in the decline rate of the US? Is there some kind of US dollar? Is there some kind of metrics involved in that? Or yeah,
Yeah,
how do you?
I mean, I'm basically simple math. Well, first is history. The Office of Management and Budget, which was the predecessor to Congressional Budget Office, says that in the decade 1970 to 1980, the US dollar lost 75% of its real purchasing power. Not coincidentally, by the way, the gold price went up 26-fold, but we'll leave that for a different discussion. When I look at that, which is to say, passes prologue, and I look at the fact that the basket of goods and services that I consume, that my household consumes, and by the way, I'm an old, fat, bald, rich cheapskate. I don't buy much. That number seems completely consistent with the fact that the basket of goods and services that I buy seems to increase in nominal price by between 8 and 10% a year compounded. In fact, that number with compounding suggests that the US dollar may lose more than 75% of its purchasing power. It's instructive to look back to 1913 when we instituted both the income tax and the Federal Reserve, that the US dollar has in that period of time lost 97% of its purchasing power. When people talk about losing 75% in the context of a precipitous decline, what it really is the continuation of a trend in motion.
Okay, so you talk about compounded interest, and it seems like it's certainly hitting us right now. An interest in, I should say, compounded interest in inflation, or that inflation compounding. Doesn't this put a squeeze and hurt on the economy? Is that what you're seeing with the loans that you make and all of that as a banker?
Well, as a banker, I'm a coward. I mean, one of the things is I'm a throwback to old-fashioned bankers. I have this quaint sense that it's easy to lend money, but it's hard to get it paid back. So there's a whole bunch of parts of the economy that I have decided to leave to my competition. An example would be credit card lending. The idea that I'm going to lend somebody money to sustain their lifestyle at 25% interest. How are those goods that they're buying now that they can't afford going to become cheaper for them in the future? I don't reckon. So I have no interest in making consumer loans. I have no interest in making auto loans. The idea that I lend money on an asset that's worth $1,500 less when the person drives it out of the lot is of no interest to me. I don't make loans. I may someday when they're in distress, but I don't make loans on commercial real estate. I'll get around eventually to the things I do make loans on. I don't make loans to private credit issuers, except in those cases where the private credit issuer sticks to one market that he or she knows well. But these sort of New York City masters of the universe who believe that they can make money as spread lenders to 40 industries, none of which they're experienced in, I have no interest in loaning those morons money. So I suspect probably that my own experience is going to be different than most commercial bankers' experience because I tend to stick to my knitting, and my knitting keeps me in a fairly tight circle. The difficulty that we're having in the economy is that my breed of banker is fairly rare. And, I'm not pretending, by the way, that I'm anywhere near as smart as the guys who run JP Morgan Chase, but I don't have to be. Those guys try to know 1,000 businesses, and I try to know four. By simple arithmetic, knowing four when you've been in them for 50 years is a whole bunch easier than knowing 1,000, particularly if by knowing 1,000, your experience is that you're 5 years out of business school. I guess there's some structural differences between what I do and what they do. But the problems are larger than just the bankers, Andy. I think it's important to look at the underlying financial underpinnings of society, which a banker must do. At the federal level, before your mistakes and my mistakes, or rather, looking, I guess, at our collective mistakes, at the federal level, before state and local debt, we're almost $40 trillion upside down. That's a big number. People hear 40 trillion and their eyes glaze over because they can't conceptualize it. Whether or not you conceptualize it, you're going to have to pay for it. So you got to begin to get your head around that number. But that number is less scary than a different number. That number is the unfunded value, net present value of unfunded entitlement promises. Look at me on the screen, old people, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. We've promised old folks $120 trillion in benefits, and we don't have the money. I'm not suggesting we're going to get a lot of hate in your comment section. Guys are going to say, well, I paid in, I deserve it. Whether you deserve it or not doesn't matter. It's not there. I've paid into Social Security for 60 years. You can't get blood from a stone. Stones don't breathe. And so when we talk about the issues that we face in society or the issues that I face as a banker, I think we need to start at square one. We need to understand that as a society, we've lived beyond our means. And there's a reckoning coming. And that reckoning is partially going to result in the decline in purchasing power of the US dollar. Here's why. There's two ways out of this $40 trillion in on-balance sheet liabilities and $120 trillion in off-balance sheet. By the way, that number is $160 trillion. The IRS estimate of the private net worth of all Americans combined is 171 trillion.
Gosh.
So of our private net worth, 160 trillion is spoken for by federal debt and deficits. And that number increases between on and off balance sheet liabilities to the tune of $4 trillion a year, pardon me, a war, $4 trillion a year before the war. Now, there's two ways out. We can be honest like the Argentines and default. We could do that. send a letter to the bondholders, and by the way, the social security recipients, and say, yeah, well, we know what you promised. Too bad, so sad. No money, strong letter to follow. That's not the American way. We kick the can down the road. That's what we do. So we're going to have a dishonest default. We're going to not honor the nominal value of our obligations by inflating away the net present value. If you take that $160 trillion and you devalue it in real terms by three quarters, that number becomes much more manageable. And I think that's what happens. Is it pernicious? Yes. Is it going to happen? Almost guaranteed. Can you vote it out of existence? No. You need to prepare for it. That's what you need to do. To the extent that you think that your 2026 fixed income is going to sustain your current lifestyle in 2036, you have a rude awakening. What costs you $1,000 now will cost you $4,000 then. So you need to adjust your savings, your income, and your expenditures, and you need to begin to do it now.
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That being said, if you could work out just really what does this look like for small businesses? For example, maybe I run a small business. I employ eight people, but maybe I'm a bad example because I'm in a great space. But the mom and pop car wash down the road from just literally a quarter of a mile from my office here, or the Mexican restaurant or the Italian restaurant that's a quarter of a mile up from the road from my office here. Are they gonna even make it? Or yeah, talk to me about that.
I think the Mexican restaurant that has better food than the Mexican restaurant a mile from you is going to be fine. It's going to be less generous than it has been in the past. The car wash that leaves your car dirty, not so much, right?
Point well taken. Depends on the
You're
business.
in the best possible position. You have a business yourself where you add value. You're focused on doing your job for your customers. You're investing in yourself. You're investing in your reputation. I happen to know you as a human being. You're going to outcompete most people who compete against you. That's going to give you pricing power. To the extent that you provide a good or ser goods or services that are demanded 10 years from now, and to the extent that you outcompete your competition providing those, your pricing will be able to keep pace with inflation. To the extent that you're an also-ran, you're in a world of hurt. And if your mentality is that the way you maintain your standard of living is to show up for your job and rent your time, as opposed to creating utility for your customers, whether you own the business or not, you're really in for a world of hurt. People need to remember that their income is ultimately a function of the utility that they generate for others. Creating a good or service that somebody is willing to consume voluntarily in return for their money, the return that they got for their goods and services. Wealth is the surplus of utility created relative to the utility consumed. The delta between those two, creating more than you consumed, is how you become wealthy. People have all kinds of conflated ideas about how and why they get paid and what wealth is. And that all needs to change.
How, when you say that all needs to change, how might it change, or how do you see it changing?
Takes time, but through the decade of the 70s, Americans learned their lesson with inflation. They learned their lesson mostly with government, too. The decade of the 70s had a whole series of miscreants. And then there was the Reagan Revolution. Now, the Reagan Revolution failed. Make no mistake. Nobody really wanted to cut government. They wanted to cut other people's government. But there was a wide plurality of people who bought into the Reagan statement, which is to say the government wasn't the cure for the problem, it was the cause of the problem. As David Stockman at our conference last year pointed out, the Reagan Revolution was derailed by Congress in 90 days. It was really, truly stillborn. You may recall his talking about the fact that the Department of Government Efficiency would fail because nobody in government wanted to be efficient. And that's important to understand. But there will be a change of ethos in the next 10 years. There absolutely will be. There will be an understanding of the perniciousness of inflation. That will occur. There's zero doubt about that. There will still be millions and millions and millions of Americans who understand that the way that they get ahead is by helping people, other people get ahead, by providing goods and services for them, that they willingly part with their own money to absorb. And there will be an increasing sense, whether or not we act on it, that government is pernicious. Maybe this time, who knows? We get it right. And by the way, I'm not foreseeing a world 15 or 20 years from now that's gloomy. I see one that's better as a consequence of technology, as a consequence of real globalization. I think we got a reckoning, though, between here and there. When I talk to people, and I talk to a lot of smart people, you know, and when I talk to them about what the world looks like, what their world looks like, with the US dollar having lost 75% of its purchasing power, when I talk to them about how they maintain their lifestyle with their savings and their income, the smarter ones get a sort of a panic-stricken look on their face, which is a good thing. Coming to grips with this, although we would prefer not to have this to come to grips with, is the first way that you deal with the problem. There's a young man who I visited with last week. I think he's 23 years of age. High school education, but no more. Rural Washingtonian, you know, a resident of a place that's been absolutely decimated by, you know, the demise of the forest products industry up here. This young guy has a pickup truck, and he has some window washing tools and a power washing tool, and he now employs four or five other young men. He's making himself the sunny side of $200,000 a year. He owns his primary residence. He owns a rental house, and he's assisted one of his employees in buying a house. Now, how did he do that? Well, that's really simple. He adds value. He saves.
23? How old is he? 23?
23.
God bless him, man.
I know another young man who's a real estate agent. He's an old guy now. He's 26 or 27. He has nine properties. So I keep hearing all this stuff about it can't be done. And then I keep meeting all these young folks who are doing it.
What do you think of you bring up such a good point and well said. I guess my thought is like, is there anything specific that you see doing well? And I'm with you too, just for the record. I see that there's going to be a reckoning, whether that's tomorrow, whether that's in the next few years or whenever, but we have to have it. But also on the other side of that reckoning, I see the world and the country or whatever being a much better place. But is there a specific industry, or if you were to advise an 18 or 19 year old on what to get into, what would you say and what would you do? And to give an example of that, I have a son, or I have five kids. My youngest is 17, my oldest is 25. I've tried to talk them out of going to college, yet they're all going to college. But they're doing it without debt. They're doing it without debt. But I've tried to say, hey, go become a plumber or electrician, that sort of thing. What would you tell that 17, 18, what would you tell my kids?
Well,
That's
the
what
first thing is look at the family business. Look at a business that you're
they're
not connected.
involved.
Yeah, then it's going to work out fine. You know, if you say to them, you know, I'm paying you $25 an hour now, but I'm really not doing it. The customer is. Find a way to increase the customer's utility, and I'll find a way to increase your paycheck. This is pretty simple stuff. Inculcate in people, young and old, because the old people don't know this either, that it's creating value for others that creates compensation for yourself. That's the most important lesson. That's the most important lesson. If young people get that, the rest of it, the rest of it is largely savings. As you know, Andy, I've mentored online a lot of young people, thousands now. And I relate them to a book I read when I was 16 called Pay Yourself First. And Pay Yourself First was based on the simple premise that any money that you made from any source, you save 10% of pre-tax at the beginning. Before you paid any other bill, you paid yourself first. It didn't tell you that you couldn't have a beer or that you couldn't buy a Starbucks, or as a young man in my area, you couldn't buy yourself a dime bag of pot, you know, whatever it was, right? What it said was that you had to pay yourself first. And then it made a second very important jump. When your ability, which is to say your income, increased, your lifestyle shouldn't. And so pay yourself for it from 10% to 15%. And then the third level was be your own bank. Yes, your car breaks down or your truck gets too old or something, you have to buy a new one. Borrow the down payment from yourself and pay yourself 1% simple interest per month. In other words, yes, take money out of your savings to buy that truck, but understand and budget to pay your savings back.
Plus
Applying
interest, plus interest.
those simple techniques guarantees that you will remain solvent while those around you become insolvent.
That is great advice. So another thing I wanted to chat with you about is I mentioned this to you briefly online. I read a book about 30 years ago, and it actually, as I reflected on it, became one of the most important books I've read during that time in the past 30 years. It is by your colleague and somebody I looked up to, James Dale Davidson and
Right.
Lord Meesmog. And the book was entitled The Sovereign Individual, and it was just so profound, I thought, and that was that the world is actually going to get smaller because of technology and just because really the weight of the nation state just being unmanageable and no longer solvent, as you've alluded to. Recently, we've seen specifically to Canada, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alberta voted to secede, which I thought was at the very least interesting, if not amusing. My question to you is, do you see that happening more? And what does that look like really here in North America and really throughout the world?
Well, the premise of the sovereign individual was the ultimate manifestation of that, which is to say the atomizing of politics. The concept of the sovereign individual is that you yourself are sovereign
Right.
and that your relationship with other people needs to be voluntary and consensual, not by communal force. That's different than what they're proposing in Alberta. In Alberta, they're proposing a local oppressor rather than a national oppressor.
But is a
And
local oppressor better?
I don't know. I mean, I really truly don't know. I think no oppressors are better. The model I like, if we're going to have a collective model, is the science fiction model around files, popularized recently by Doug Casey, who suggests that people should organize according to values and trust, as opposed necessarily to ethnic and national lines. Now we're talking big stuff, stuff that's unlikely to happen formally in our lifetime. But what is a consensual, voluntary group of people? Well, among other things, it's a company. Battlebank, my most recent company, is a file. Battlebank isn't a bank like other banks. It's a bank that doesn't seek to be all things to all people. It's a bank that seeks to lend money against precious metals, or a bank that seeks to lend money and interest in industries that understands, not 1,000 industries like a big one. So in effect, Battle Bank or any other company like your own company that services its customers is a function of the same atomization that you observed with regards to Alberta. It's just that you're doing it on a manageable, consensual, voluntary, and honorable basis.
As opposed to on a basis with a gun or a threat of jail
Listen,
time.
there are some states that are more benign than others. I'm thinking about moving to one, but that's a different question. And it's certainly one that people need to pay attention to in terms of thriving instead of merely surviving over the next 10 years. But people owe themselves asking the bigger question. People need to ask how they can be responsible for their own better future, how they can service their customers better. If there's a need in society that they can fill voluntarily, that they can fill profitably, how they do that. If there's a need for philanthropy, how they can address that, not how they can cause other people to address it.
I thought about what you just said, and I want to work that out a little bit more, but I thought about what you just said about Doug Casey. I want to paraphrase, correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was in his new science fiction book, but going down to your file or organizing yourself around a file. And I actually thought of not only on the corporate level, but I thought on the religious level. So you talked about philanthropy. That is, I mean, I'll just be very base here. That's giving, right? On a church level, just because, and you're not compelled to do that. You do that because of you share the same values with those people, whoever you go to church with, no matter what religion you are. Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I maybe that's not a question, but it's just a statement. That's a very interesting concept. And I'm wondering if society will organize themselves around that more, whether it's corporate in a corporate structure or a religious structure or a humanistic structure, if that makes sense.
Well, if we assume, which I think we have to arithmetically, that we're going to be less able to deal with society's problems politically because the nation state is approaching insolvency, what I think that means necessarily is that other forms of social organization have to step in and fill the void.
Which they did in the past, right?
Correct. I mean, there is a private sector. Alternative to most of what the state does. It's called insurance.
Right.
What are pensions? Well, they're a form of insurance. Social Security was meant to be insurance. It's a transfer payment. And my suspicion is that we're in for a period of time, pardon me, a tumultuous period of time, when some forms of service, which traditionally haven't been met by profit-making organizations, will be met more by community-based organizations, churches, and others. I try to be involved, and by the way, I would prefer that all of my philanthropic activities were carried on for profit. I would prefer to pay somebody to succeed rather than donate money to them. But I'm interested, as an example, in microcredit, setting up banks for extraordinarily poor people, mostly women in frontier market countries, and doing it with my money, not stealing your money because it's my interest, my own money. I'm interested in rehabilitating nonviolent offenders and giving them life skills. The state is supposed to do that, but the state doesn't do it. So I've got to do it, and I'm not bitching about that. That's fine. I'm interested in habitat preservation. And I think increasingly that we're going to come to realize that, first of all, our preferences, the things that are important to me, are my preferences. I have no right to ask you to fund them. But also, if I fund them, I'm involved in these microcredit banks. I'm involved in habitat preservation. What that means is, provided I don't make too egregious mistakes, that these organizations are better run, that I get more for the money. And it also means that I go to bed comfortable, knowing that I didn't steal your money to fund my priorities. Now, that doesn't seem to trouble a lot of people, but it may 10 years from now.
Well, that's such a great concept too, because then if a giving organization, if a philanthropic organization, a mentorship organization, whatever, if they do a poor job or if they commit fraud like we see now, you can fire them or you can withdraw your money, and that's in a way firing them. It's also interesting to me, just looking back on historically speaking, that's just the way things are run. Oh, this is a point I wanted to make. Is a friend of mine came to me and was telling me about taxation. And to everybody and everybody listening, I pay my taxes. I maximize my deductions, but I pay my taxes, everybody. But just how I should be, how is it wasn't morally wrong. It was morally right to pay as much, or the state was morally right, I guess, to take my money to feed the poor or whatever have you. And again, I'm all for feeding the poor. But I asked him, I was like, well, do you voluntarily pay more taxes? Then if you want it, why don't you voluntarily pay more?
What the person is telling you is that he's a better judge of the
Right?
outcomes of your capital than you are, that his priorities are so important to humankind that he has a call on your means. Now, if you take that to its illogical conclusion, what that means is that this gentleman is a slave owner
Yeah.
and you are the slave. Poll after poll after poll has shown that people wouldn't pay tax if there wasn't the threat of enforcement. Well, that shows that the payment of tax is not voluntary. What is the involuntary taking of the fruits of one's labor?
Theft.
One could say that that was slavery. In fact, I've decided that since they only enslave me for 6.5 months a year, that it isn't actually slavery. And they can't sell me so far. I mean, the United States couldn't say to Canada, listen, if you give me 50 million bucks, we'll give you a call on all of Rick's taxes for the rest of his life or something like that. So it's probably just extortion.
Yeah.
But the gentleman who spoke to you is telling you that his aspiration for your money is more important than your aspiration,
Yep.
which is to say that in terms of the furtherance of his goals, he's in favor of extortion.
Yep. No, absolutely.
Now, they say that, well, no, it's not really extortion. It's a consequence of an election, which is to say that you aren't extorted by a person, you're extorted by a gang.
Yeah.
It's very much like the old libertarian pin. Four coyotes and a lamb get together and they vote on a lunch menu.
Right. Yeah, I wonder who wins. So you made a comment about 10 minutes ago about just and I don't want you to tell me what specific states you're looking at, but it's an interesting comment because I think that's happening more is just again going with the Alberta example, just you're seeing a migration, or do you see this as maybe the question of high cost, poorly run states to states that are better run and have a lower cost of living and allow you to keep more of your money? Are you seeing that happening more?
I do. I was born in the People's Republic of California,
Me too. Me too.
and they taxed me out.
Yeah.
I came from there to the state of Washington, which I dearly love, by the way. I adore this place. It's drop-dead gorgeous. I live in a rural part where I have neighbors so nice I'd pay to have them, and I do. During the period of time I've lived in the state of Washington, 6 years, the state has gone from the 45th highest tax rate in the country to the fifth highest. It's repriced. But something else has happened. I've been lucky in life. I've worked hard. I've worked smart. I've saved. And I've been very lucky. And the consequence of that is that my income and my net worth is, by common standards, quite high. And there's become a political ethos in the United States that people like me, people who have achieved financially, are the enemy.
Right.
The fact that I've created goods and services that millions of people have bought voluntarily, and they bought it because the goods and services that I provided to them, they believed were worth more than the fruits of their own labor, is now considered to be villainy. Again, Doug Casey, for years, rich people were regarded by society as milk cattle. That is, resources to be milked. Hated, but milked. But in certain states, New York, California, Washington, our status has changed from being milk cattle to being beef. And there's a very different form of sacrifice on behalf of the cow. It's much less sustainable. So I'm considering, well, the first thing I'm doing is I'm contributing to the legal bills to challenge the constitutionality of Washington's new tax. I'm tired of running. I'd like to fight. At 73, I don't have as much fight left in me as I once did, but I have more backbone. But if I fail, and I think that's probable, the judiciary in Washington are lackeys of a very larcenous legislature. We are going to be looking at residential property in Florida, concurrent with our Boca Raton conference in July 6th through 10th.
Okay, number one, Florida is my second home. I love the state of Florida. The only reason I don't live in Florida is because my life is here in Georgia and they just tax me just enough where I'm uncomfortable, but I'm not compelled to move yet. Talk to me about this conference. I'm going to be there. It's been a game changer for myself and my family, my portfolio over the last couple of years since I've been there. And it's an amazing time. Tell me about that. And you, congratulations, you're sold out for the live in person, but people can still view
So
online.
the first thing to know about the conferences is it doesn't try to be all thing to all people. It's about natural resources. If you care about sector index funds or fidelity timing switches or something like that, don't come. And the second thing is for hardworking people. We're going to give you 46 hours of dense programming in 4 days. All as you can attest, Andy, it's a lot of work. If you buy the Sunday paper to do the crossword puzzle, stay at home. This is the dense stuff. The fact that we've been in existence for 30 years says a lot about the conference. It has delivered to people for 30 years. How do we do that? Well, several ways. We have great big picture thinkers. We had David Stockman last year talk about why the Department of Government Efficiency was gonna fail. And what a call. And he did it from experience. He was the director of the Office of Management and Budget under Reagan. He watched it fail once before for the same reasons. The big picture thinkers tell you about the way the world is, not the way that CNBC or Fox, or for that matter, the Democrats or the Republicans, would have you believe it is, but rather the way it is. Not good, not bad, not ugly, just the way it is. And then we take that information and we put it through a natural resources filter. In other words, we don't try to be all things for all people. We're helping people be better resource investors. So we take that big picture pragmatism and we run it through a filter established by portfolio managers and analysts who have been in the business for 40 years, not newsletter writers who made their reputation in 12 months of a hot market, but rather people who have existed in the market and prospered in the market for 40 years. It's important that once you have the paradigm, that you employ that paradigm profitably. We go from there to a great group of people, resource entrepreneurs who've built multi-billion dollar companies from scratch. We call those guys the living legends. And they tell us how they did it. They tell us how their experience has made them and can make you a better investor. And importantly, this year, we're going to make them tell you how you find the next legend, the person with a $10 million company today who's going to build the $5 billion company out of it. We do a couple other things that I think are instructive. We interview every single exhibitor before the conference and every speaker too, so that you have the ability to arrive at the conference forearmed. In other words, we prepare you for the 4 days by cheating. We make you work more than 4 days. And we record the entire proceedings so that you have access to it afterwards. But we do a couple other things that I think are very interesting. No public company exhibitor is allowed on my conference floor if I don't personally own the stock. Now, some would describe that as a conflict of interest, but what it really is your guarantee that I have vetted every single company. There's no other conference in the world that restricts admission like that. We turn down more exhibitors than we accept. It's important to know that. And that allows us to do something really, truly extraordinary. Ours is the only conference in the world with an unconditional money-back guarantee. Whether you attend live or via live stream, if you, in your discretion, don't believe that you got your money's worth, I'll give you your money back. You might not be invited back next year, but you'll get your money back. There's no other conference on the planet that has enough confidence in their content and the ability of that content to make their attendees money that they offer an unconditional money-back guarantee, but we have for 30 years. Now, in 30 years, because our content has been good and because of the general goodness of our customer, we've had to refund about 0.1% of the tuition charged. And by the way, the most frequent complaint about the conference was that it was over the attendees' heads. In other words, we gave them more content than they were prepared to absorb. But that's a valid reason. So I think for all of those reasons, and also for the reason that I think the next 10 years is going to be particularly attractive for precious metals and natural resources, that any person with the time and the means to attend should attend.
Well, myself and my team will be there again this year. And again, Rick, thank you for inviting us. It was fantastic the years I've been. And I've gotten out so much more value than I could ever give you, is that's what I'll say. I'll put a link to that in the show notes below on both the YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Rick, talk to me, and we'll land the plane on this just real quick. Just talk to me about the natural resource sector. We have had energy prices elevated. We've had gold, it seems like gold and silver both have found somewhat of a base here. Is any of this surprising to you, and are you looking at any these sectors to make acquisitions, or are you looking at what sectors do look attractive to you?
You know, Andy, I prepared for this interview last weekend by replaying a couple of our old interviews.
God bless you.
Well, one interesting thing is I was pounding the table on oil and gas. And it's be not because I knew there was going to be a war. The
Right.
price levels that we're enjoying, if that's the right phrase, in the oil market are levels that I had anticipated in 19, pardon me, in 2029. In other words, the war front-ended the price escalation that I thought would occur as a consequence of declining sustaining capital investments. Talking to your audience about Exxon at $95 was a much easier discussion than talking to them about it at $180. So people need to
Right.
understand that. The
Right.
oil and gas thesis is intact, but I'm not trying to say it's cheap. I'm not saying it's expensive either, because if this war goes on, you're going to see a very different level of oil prices. The oil prices you see now are prices in anticipation of rationing. The prices that you'll see in 10 days or 2 weeks if it keeps going are prices that are a function of allocating oil to money. Real rationing by price, that's very different. But the sector is no longer hated. As you know, Andy, I try to go from sector to sector based on hate. And unfortunately, in my sector, nothing is hated, which
Right.
means in the very near term, there isn't very much that's compelling. The only objection to that that I could raise, and it's not really an objection, the only counterpoint is that almost all Americans are underinvested in precious metals and precious metal stocks. And while they're nowhere near as cheap as when they were 5 years ago when you and I first started talking, relative to the level that they're going to be 5 years from now or 10 years from now, and relative to the market share that they enjoy in most people's portfolios, they're still very underrepresented. The very high quality gold companies, by the way, I interview tomorrow, Jundi today, the CEO of Agnico Eagle,
I'm jealous.
finest operating mining company in the country. The analysts' expectations around Agnico Eagle are based on $3,200 gold. It's kind of hard not to beat the expectation when the expectation's $3,200 and you're selling the stuff for 46. You know, that's the stuff of earning surprises. So there's a reasonable amount of opportunity in the precious metals business. If you're like me and you've been involved in the precious metals business for 3 decades, you don't need to increase your allocation. But precious metals and precious metals equities in the U.S. market comprise about 0.5% of total savings and investment assets in the United States. The 4-decade mean was 2%. So if those markets merely return to mean, demand quadruples where supply is limited. It is estimated, and I don't know if it's true, nor do they, it's estimated by JP Morgan Chase that the market share of precious metals and precious metals were like equities at their peak in 1981 was between 7 and 8%. I have no way to verify it, and they admit they don't either. But if you look at a circumstance where the market share to revert to mean grows fourfold in an environment where the US dollar loses 75% of its purchasing power, and arguably where gold maintains its purchasing power, that would suggest that the increase in the gold price over 10 years, if I'm right about the dollar, increases in nominal terms at least threefold. So that makes a reasonable case. Well, it's difficult for me to understand why people don't own physical gold as a savings product. It's grown at 9% compounded since the year 2000. You know, it's really difficult for me to understand anybody who wouldn't own physical gold that has any savings whatsoever. It's interesting. It's difficult for me to believe, too, that anybody who categorizes himself or herself as an investor doesn't own investment positions in the highest quality gold stocks, the Wheaton Precious, the Franco-Nevadas, the Agnico Eagles. And for those who are willing to do the work, those who are willing not just to enjoy beta, the outperformance of gold relative to other sectors, speculating in single asset producers or in mid-range producers, which likely will be taken over, or really truly speculating in juniors and exploration stage companies, given that you're likely going to enjoy the wind in your back for the next 10 years, it's difficult for me to explain the underinvestment that people have in precious metals.
Another reason why to come to your conference. I picked up several of the companies at your conference over the last couple of years in my portfolio, and they've significantly outperformed. So another plug. That's a shameless plug for your conference, Rick. We're gonna leave on that. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I could
Yeah.
talk forever like this, so shut me
Couldn't
up.
we? I always just really enjoy our time together. I want to thank you for sharing your time with me. If people want to do business with you, if they want to reach out to you, how abouts do they go doing that?
Whole bunch of ways, but I'll just give you a few. The easiest and the cheapest is to go to my website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. You can list your natural resource stocks there, the ones you own, not the ones you hope to own, the ones you own, and I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. And I'll do that for free. And I'll comment on individual companies if I think my comments might have value. Please no crypto. Please no tech stocks. Leave an old guy to do what he does. The second thing that I have that's free, and this is a really good deal, is the Rule Classroom. There's well over 300 hours of educational programming there, including a 5.5 hour long series called Introduction to Natural Resource Stock Investing. This is 50 years of my experience, plus hundreds of years of my good friend's experience, all on a site that's curated for free. Money back guarantee, free. The third thing I need to say, well, come to the conference, of course, we've talked about that. The third thing I have to say, in terms of doing business with me, if for any reason at all your listeners are unsatisfied with their current bank, and I suspect that's every single listener you have, check out Battle Bank. You know, there's $3 trillion on deposit in the US that isn't getting paid interest. We pay interest on your checking account. Think that through. We don't require you to save in US dollars if you don't want to. We'll allow you to save in 20 currencies. We'll allow you to save in gold, silver, platinum, or palladium too. And we will allow you to monetize your stack without selling it. You can establish a credit line against your bullion. You don't need to borrow it, but you can take it down if you need it. without having to sell your gold and silver. We believe at Battle Bank that your IRA is your IRA, not a receptacle for Wall Street's product. So your IRA, your checkbook IRA at every bank, can buy private credit without the president's permission. You can buy crypto. You can buy gold. You can invest in a subway franchise. You can own an Airbnb. There's a whole bunch of things you can do at Battle Bank that you can't do at your bank, because at Battle Bank, your IRA is your IRA. Very, very, very important difference. It's a community bank where community is defined by aspiration and by value. So if you feel like you're part of a self-actualized community, check out Battle Bank. We'll beat your bank.
Excellent. I'll put all of this in the show notes below again on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Rick, always a pleasure. I'm jealous of people that get to spend more time with you. Look forward to seeing you in Florida, my friend.
I'm available and I look forward to seeing you in Florida. I hope you're coming on the cruise, going up and down the Intercoastal Canal drinking with Rick.
I got in. Steve and I
Good.
both got in.
Good for
So,
you. Good
yeah.
for you. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Looking forward to it, my friend. All right.
Maybe I'll see my new house on the canal.
I will be there. Take care, my friend.
All right. Thank you.